Your neighborhood gives me the creeps. Your neighborhood gives me the creeps. Ooh, your neighborhood gives me the creeps.
Hi, everybody, and welcome to Weird Chicago Radio. My name is professional psychic Ken Melvoin-Berg. Adam Seltzer, unfortunately, is out of town at the moment. He's in Los Angeles visiting his brother.
Right.
But we have a special guest with us here in the studio today, and he's the author of a new book of the Weird Chicago series. It's called Fatal Drop. Now, first of all, Bill, I wanted to thank you for coming down today. Even more so, thank you for being a little bit more sober than normal.
Thank you very much. Betty insisted. My wife, I thank her for taking a chance, and frankly, her chance didn't pay off so well. I'm trying to fix that up. That's why I'm writing books now.
Well, hopefully we can give you a little bit of press from this and maybe sell one or two of these.
Before you talk about me,
you want to talk about Betty?
The nice guy. Why don't you talk about the new Weird Chicago, the book? I've listened to all your podcasts. You never talk about your book. Tell us about Weird Chicago, the book.
Weird Chicago, the book, has been out for, about 2 months now, and it's doing quite well. This is the book that Adam and Troy and myself had chipped in together.
Right.
We wrote it, and it is doing phenomenal. It is everything that we had done on our tours and then some. It also opened the doors. It's a huge encyclopedia of all of the history, the hauntings, the UFOs, the shark attacks, the gangster era, the serial killers of the city of Chicago. And it's done up, and it was the very first of the Weird Chicago series books that we had coming out.
And look at that. The thing's like the size of a phone book, too. It is the ultimate of the Chicago ghost books. Because I know, because I work for Weird Chicago, that these guys do their research. They're not just basing things on straight hearsay.
We leave that to the amateurs. Include yourself in with us, Bill. You are part of the team now, man.
I'm behind the scenes. I'm the man behind the curtain to whom you are.
Well, you are. I would love to have you do a tour sometime, but we'll take a little bit and we'll polish the rough edges. We'll polish those rough edges.
I perform all the time, as you know, and from the back. I perform.
You're a blues musician, aren't you?
Yes, I learned on Maxwell Street. There was a man by the name of Anderson Punch who used to walk around with he had a chicken on his head. They called
him the Chicken Man. Yeah, the Chicken Man.
He normally played the accordion because the chickens danced better to it. But he liked to sing this song, Casey Jones, and he taught me to play the guitar. And some other guys on Maxwell Street taught me to play more of the guitar, so I learned to play.
Would you be willing to play something for us today?
I can play you a little bit. I can't play well because there was a shuffleboard accident recently.
Well, I noticed the hand.
So, yeah, you're noticing this is going to be... Adam's got a guitar in here, right? I'll get
out. I think so. Somewhere over there.
A good blues man can smell a guitar. It's my curse too. Is my nose, you know? Is you can sense ghosts. I can smell them, and they smell terrible.
Well, thank God. I've always said, thank God we can't taste the ghost.
You want to know somebody who really knows bad smells? Betty. I was sitting on the porch, that's what blues men do. I was sitting on the porch, me and Freaky Frankie T-Dog Miller, we were sitting on the porch. We nod our heads, we nod our heads. That's what blues men do, we sit on the porch and we nod our heads. Because the barbecue burned down, my baby she done left town. My dog he's fully ferocious, my grammar is frankly atrocious. I nod my head. Unlike a lot of people that I wrote about who could no longer nod their heads, although if you held them up, I suspect they would bob around. See, this is the thing about the blues. You can do it with only two fingers remaining. The barbecue burned down. My baby, she done left town. I got a dog, he's ferocious. My grammar is frankly atrocious. I nod my head. I'm the seventh son of the seventh son of San Cardinale Il Diavolo. He didn't really die, you know. I said that he did in the book. That's what I'm supposed to say.
Wild
and that's
Bill.
How you do it with only two fingers.
You and Django Reinhardt, my friend. You and Django.
I can tell you a few stories. I won't.
But not today. We'll save that for another podcast.
We'll save that for another time. Let me talk a little more about
it. Yeah, no, first of all, I would like to know what inspired you to first write about your book, Fatal Drop. And first of all, what is the book about? Just in a nutshell,
Fatal
what is the book
Drop
about?
Fatal Drop is the story of hangings in the city of Chicago. I knew you guys were interested in that kind of thing because you'd been at the courthouse and stuff. And then I read your book, and I think Weird Chicago is the best Chicago history book that there's ever been. You guys dug up a lot of stuff that even I didn't know, but you missed my favorite story.
What was that?
That was the story of Sam Cardinella Il Diavolo.
Oh, let's hear about that.
Sam Cardinella was a guy who ran a pool hall that was actually a college of crime on 22nd Street in a building that, according to you, is now haunted.
Right, sounds like Fagin.
Apparently this guy read Oliver Twist and thought it was a how-to manual or something. He would teach kids, like teenagers, to commit crimes and then take a cut of the money. Then he would, likely as not, he was probably cheating them out of their share with loaded dice. He was notorious for saying things like, okay, there's this guy who runs a juke joint over here, he's got some money hid. If he won't tell you where the money is, stick a knife in his side. If he still won't tell you, twist it around a little bit. Then after you get the rest of the money, stick it all the way in and kill him. And, eventually, when they caught up with these guys in 1920, over the course of 6 months, they had committed something like 24 holdups and two or 300 holdups and at least 24 murders in the process.
Good lord!
The guy who really ratted
this is between
out,
1910 to 1920.
Yeah, this was 1920-ish when they finally caught up with him. One of his main lieutenants was a kid named Nicholas the Choir Singer Viana, and we got his picture in this book, and Cardinella spent his time in prison refusing to eat food. He freaked the guards out, and these were guys who had seen everybody do everything twice, but they were scared to death of Sam Cardinella. They said there was almost something satanic about the man. People would describe him as like a human spider. And then
really?
On the night before his hang, well, they hanged Viana first. They hanged Viana for his 19th birthday. Then the night before Cardinella was killed, he had lost about 40 pounds already by not eating. They brought his family in. He would speak in the whole gang spoke in such a thick Sicilian dialect that nobody could understand him. Even people who spoke Sicilian fluently could not understand these guys. But they did recognize one word. He kept saying Viana's name over and over. And this kind of confused the people because nobody knew why he would be wasting his last day with his 5 children and his wife talking about this traitor to the gang who was already dead and gone. Next day, they brought him in to be hanged. They walked him down the scaffold, and he broke down. He started crying and screaming. He collapsed. He pitched a fit. According to Ernest Hemingway, he lost control of his sphincter muscle. Eventually, they had
What was Ernest Hemingway doing there?
Ernest Hemingway was not there. Ernest Hemingway wrote a 3-paragraph short story about the hanging of Sam Cardinella that was based
and about his sphincter muscle, apparently.
Yes, he this is something the newspaper reports usually left out, but Ernest Hemingway colored in that detail himself. But it's entirely likely these things tended to happen on the scaffold. But eventually they couldn't get Cardinella to stand back up. They tied him to a chair and hanged him like that, which had happened
really?
Before in Chicago. It had happened before. But they then brought the body down and gave it to the custody of his friends, who took it out instead of to like a hearse like you would normally see. They brought it out to a private ambulance that was waiting in the jail yard. When the police opened this up, they saw 3 or 4 doctors and a nurse standing around inside of the back of this thing. And the warden kind of smelled a rat and said, "Okay, don't let them leave for a while." When they cracked it open, they found that they were rubbing Cardinella's wrists. They were pumping electricity into him. They were injecting him with some form of stimulant, and it became clear that the reason that he had lost all of this weight and the reason that he had done this breakdown so that he would be hanged tied to a chair was to make sure he didn't break his neck. So by losing weight, there was less weight on the noose. By being in a chair, the drop was about 19 inches shorter than it would have been if he had been standing. Because if he had broken his neck, he was dead, and that was that. But if he just strangled to death, he believed that there was some chance they could actually bring him back to life.
Wow.
And here's the thing, the reason he was saying Viana's name, and this is difficult to ascertain. This is according to the county physician and the stories that he heard from other prisoners, is they had already tested it on Nicholas the choir boy, Viana, and it worked. They had brought Nicholas Viana. The jail people knew that they had brought him out to an ambulance. They didn't think anything of it at the time, but according to the prisoners, they brought him back to life on the table in a nearby funeral home. But then they stepped back and let him die again because he was a traitor to the gang. The whole thing had been an experiment to see if they could get it to work on Sam Cardinella. And the story is practically forgotten in Chicago now. I knew it because of my dad. He used to claim not only that it was true, but that he knew Sam Cardinella. J. Robert Nash says the story was made up by Ben Hecht, but he's wrong. Ben Hecht made up a similar story, but the Cardinella story had been going around for 30 years by then. I got the articles.
Wow, that's amazing. Now, when did public execution stop in Chicago?
Public execution stopped in Chicago after 1859.
Really?
That is when the entire state of Illinois made them all private. There was like a list of people who could be there. Physicians, a jury. They let reporters in anyway, but I think they weren't really supposed to.
Now, I heard a rumor. Now, I don't know if this is in your book or not, but I had heard a story somewhere about they had to keep a gallows in Chicago for a long time afterwards because of somebody had had their sentence that they had to be hung by the neck until dead. So until this guy was to... can you enlighten me on that? That's just a rumor. I don't know.
That was another man, a man by the name of Terrible Tommy O'Connor. He had murdered, among other people, he murdered a police officer. He murdered his best friend for not helping him with his murderous ways.
Because everybody knows that a true friend helps friends move dead bodies.
Yeah, even if you've gone straight. And this guy, he was a worshiper, basically, of a lot of earlier Chicago criminals, probably the Car Barn Bandits, who are now mostly forgotten, but they were an inspiration to a generation. These were like the last of the old-time outlaws. It was three kids who went on a crime spree and then were hanged. But anyway, Tommy O'Connor was sentenced to hang by the neck until dead, and then he escaped. And
they
never found the guy. So, but they had to hang on to the gallows even after they switched to the electric chair after 27. They needed that because his sentence said he had to be hanged, and if they ever caught him, they were going to have to hang him. That was the law. Finally, in the 1970s, a judge finally ruled that he was dead anyway, so they had to get rid of him. They sold him to a Wild West museum, who kept him till a couple of years ago. The Ripley's, believe it or not, now owns the old Chicago gallows.
Oh, that's who actually ended up buying it. I thought it was for sale on eBay, of all places.
Yeah,
they
did auction it off. It wasn't through eBay. It was through an auction house.
Through an auction house?
And they are now in a warehouse, and Ripley's, believe it or not, hopes to have it in a museum in California next year, last I talked to them.
Wow, amazing. Now, I have a couple more questions for you. Now, first of all, I understand that you're like a big Cubs fan. Is this true?
Absolutely.
And what is your feelings on the whole goat thing?
The goat thing is a publicity stunt made up by the Billy Goat Tavern, if you ask me. But then again, Betty thinks otherwise. This is one of the things that we fight about.
Do you and Betty go down to the Billy Goat at all?
We're not welcome at the Billy Goat.
I know the feeling, my friend. I know the feeling. Right. I myself am not welcome at the Billy Goat.
There are certain places that we're not just not welcome anymore. But by the way, contrary to what you may have heard, Billy Goat Tavern ain't haunted.
No, I didn't believe that it was. No.
Be kind of cool if it were.
I have heard that is it true that you may be playing at Rosa's?
I might be playing at Rosa's?
I heard that. I don't know if it's true or not.
I got two fingers, Ken.
Well, so did Django, though. And I have to say, two fingers or ten.
I'm still getting used to two fingers, but
you're a damn good guitar player.
You tell Rosa that next time I'm playing again, I'll play at Rosa's. Wild Bill Griffin.
Because I wouldn't want to see it, you know, like one of the hoity-toity places downtown. Rosa's on Armitage, that's a real blues place. Where Pine Top Perkins plays.
Can I just tell you, they're, you know, trying to find authentic blues in Chicago. That's over. It's a Disneyland thing now. Most of the guys have, like, the same three songs that they play over and over again, because that's what the tourists want to hear, is they want to hear Sweet Home Chicago, Stormy Monday, maybe Matchbox... And that's about it, really. If you go back to the old blues clubs, what I learned on Maxwell Street was really more ragtime than the blues.
Right.
What they taught me was endless variations on St. James Infirmary blues.
Now, is it true that you met Betty when she was dating one of your friends? Now, this is a rumor that I heard, and I can't substantiate it.
Who told you?
I really don't want to say, but I'll just tell you the initials are J. You know who JT is.
I know who JT is.
Is this true?
She was dating Herbert, who was a friend of mine.
Right.
This was. Back,
I heard it from JT. Though.
This was back in the days before there were Facebooks and your MySpaces and places like that, and people dated more casually because that was the only way you got a chance to get to know a girl. Because I mean, my friends and I, we were greasers. We didn't let girls hang out with us normally, and they wouldn't have wanted to hang out with us. If you wanted to get to know a pretty girl, you took her on a date, and it didn't necessarily mean anything romantic. And that's what she'd done with Herbert. But we did a double date. It was me and another girl whose name escapes me. But I believe I saw her once in 1982. She was driving in a Cadillac in the lane next to mine and looked miserable, and I always felt bad about that. But we were double dating. We were in the balcony. We were seeing this. I don't remember the name of the picture, but it was with Bogart, and it was the one where the music goes, la, 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 la.
Casablanca?
It wasn't that one. I'd remember that one. But it goes, I just remember because I wasn't watching the movie, because about midway through I started kissing Betty.
And, that's actually kind of a sweet story.
So I just remember the music from that particular picture.
Now, I know you've had a rough and tumble past, and I've heard it's been said that you used to run around with some gangs called the Gaylords. Now, I don't know if that's true or not. Can you confirm that?
We're in their territory, the almighty Gaylords.
Right.
I think the last of them actually just moved out of the neighborhood.
Did you run with those guys back in the day?
No.
No?
No, it's not.
But you knew them all, right?
I knew everybody.
Okay, I didn't know if you were actually in the gang or you just were, you knew the fellas?
I knew everybody. I'm not what you call a joiner.
Okay.
I was like a satellite member of every gang. I brokered many a peace accord.
Well, let's get back to the book, Bill. Now, first of all, let's see, the book is coming out, I believe, this week, isn't it?
Yeah, January 9th is the official release date for Fatal Drop. You can order it through Whitechapel Press or through your esteemed blog.
Oh, either one. You can order through the blog as well. That's awesome.
Right. Well, there are, what do you call them, links.
Right. There's links over to just about everything there. Now, there's one particular interesting story that I was wondering if you could tell me something about a guy named Zephyr Davis?
Zephyr Davis was the first African-American to be executed in the city of Chicago.
Really? Let's hear a little bit about him.
Zephyr Davis was, apparently he was not a pleasant human being. One day he was alone with a girl at work. He worked at one of those nasty shoe-making sweatshops, as I recall it. He murdered her. He murdered her good. Given that mostly because he was African American, he was reported as a rapist and murderer. In fact, he did not rape her. He murdered her. He cut her up really good. Apparently, she had mouthed off to him, and Zephyr Davis was a man with a temper.
Okay.
But yeah, it was kind of a media circus, as these things go.
Was it more to do with his race than the crimes he committed, or was that just a combination of both?
A bit of both, I'm sure. Well, they really threw due process out the window for him. When they caught him, they said, you're under arrest, and Zephyr says, where's your warrant? And the guy pulled out a gun and said, here's my warrant. And that's, under the Constitution of the United States, that's a little bit. If he had a better lawyer, he could have gotten around that, I would have to think. Now, I didn't mention it in the book, but one of the next guys who was executed, the next African Americans, was a guy named Black Bear, who used to hang out in Dead Man's Alley in the middle of Hell's Half Acre, which was that block south, just south of where the library is now.
Right, right.
Which is it was brothels and brothels and whiskey bars and.
Sounds like my kind of joint.
Yeah. That was Sweet Home Chicago. Sorry, Betty.
I think Betty will forgive you that one. Betty, we really appreciate you lending us Bill tonight. Now, speaking of women, though, I would like to hear, is there any stories about women who had been... Did they even hang any women in the gallows?
Not in Chicago. There was one
not
or
in
two
Chicago?
In the city of Illinois. In the state of Illinois, there were a couple of women who were executed.
But nobody here in Chicago?
Not in Chicago. Troy's got a good story. There's one of them who was executed. She's still buried next to the guy she killed.
Really?
It was her husband. His tombstone says, killed by murder, and hers says, killed by hanging.
Well, is there any other stories that you would like to share with us today, Bill, before you have to take off? I know that Betty is looking a little bit impatient over there.
I owe her as much to come home on time tonight. I owe her as much.
You're starting to get at the DTs there, I think, a little bit, Bill. You need a cocktail? Can I get you something?
I always need a cocktail.
Do you have one last story?
I've already got one. Pick one out of the book. Why don't you?
All right, let's hear a little bit more. Actually, I know what I'd want to hear about is... All right,
what do you want to hear?
Let's hear a little bit something about Adolf Lutgard.
Adolf Lutgard. Now, was a man...
Now, is he in the book? Now, I don't even know if he's in the book.
I believe I may have mentioned him. He wasn't hanged. This my book is about people who got hanged.
Oh, that's true. He committed suicide, didn't he?
He died in prison.
Exactly. Was it a suicide or a murder?
I'm not sure. It might have been he might have been malnourishing himself enough that it basically counted as one. Recently, they just if you go online, look up Alchemy of Bones. This is by a guy named Robert. It's a book and a website. They just found a photograph of Adolf Lutgard in prison. And it's funny because in most of the pictures I've seen of him, he's this, you know, big Eastern European dude with the beard. He looks like a guy you don't want to mess with. But in prison, he looked, you know, he was shaved and looked like a big goofball.
Oh, that's
not
funny.
As big a goofball as Johann Hock, who was this froggy little guy who may or may not have been a pupil of H.H. Holmes, a guy you guys never quit talking about, and married something like 45 women, they think, and killed about a third.
Wow.
They hanged him, but they hanged him good.
Wow. The last thing I kind of wanted to hear about is the Shablowski brothers. What about them?
The Shablowski brothers. Let me see. Let me just get... Oh, man, these were a couple of guys. The only thing particularly notable about them is that they were hanged on the gallows' busiest day, a day in 1912, when five people were hanged on the Chicago gallows. That was a record for Chicago, but more interesting than them was this guy Jennings, who was hanged the same day. You know, what's interesting about him is that they convicted him because of fingerprints.
Really?
They had never done that before.
And what year was this?
This was 1912.
1912. Oh, I know one last thing that I need to find out about. I've heard that it was rumored, and you could probably correct me on this, but it was rumored.
It's a rumor.
Yeah, well, that's absolutely true. But that Chicago had the worst hangman in the United States. Now, I don't know if that's true or not. Was that
now
true?
Now you're looking at a pretty impressive question, because who knows who the hangman actually was. Now, the gallows in Chicago, starting in about the 1870s, 1880s, had this compartment on the back where the hangman would stand. So
yeah.
Nobody would ever see who the hangman was.
Oh, really? So they didn't know his identity?
No, it was a big secret. And the sheriff would wave a signal, and then the guy would cut the rope. And so nobody would see him. But later on, the county physician swore that there was nobody in the box. The sheriff was doing everything, and they just had the little box there kind of to take the pressure off of the sheriff.
Right.
So really, most likely, I would say that there was at one point a guy in the compartment, and then as they renovated things over the years, it just housed the weights and the pulleys and stuff. They had fairly sophisticated equipment.
Now, was it true that the hangings here, like, it was rumored that they took a little bit longer than most other places?
Yeah,
and that's
a good
reason?
Hangman will get a guy from in his cell to dead at the end of the rope, 30 seconds or less, or triple your money back. In Chicago, they tended to strangle to death over a long period of time.
And why do you think that is? Was that malfunction of the equipment, or was the guy who was doing it?
Whoever was in charge generally did really seem to suck at their job.
And that means they just didn't make the knots correctly, or didn't weigh the body right, or measure
the little volume. There's a lot of things you want to take into account, and these guys were generally not engineers who were in charge of the hangings. They didn't take all the measurements properly. They just kind of let them drop and hope for the best. But Adam keeps telling me, and I have no document, so I didn't put it in the book, but what's this about you finding his office?
Oh, yeah, we found
you,
it over...
You tell this one. This is the addendum to Fatal Drop, folks. Yours for free on the Weird Chicago podcast.
Now, this is one of the things. I had been doing an investigation with a Chicago Sun-Times reporter. This is back in 97 or 98. We were investigating some hauntings at the Reed Murdoch warehouse in what was then a Bob Chin's restaurant. We had seen and heard a number of things from staff members about the hauntings there. I, as a professional psychic, had gone in, and I sensed some of the ghost activity in the upper level of the restaurant, went down to the basement area of that building, and what we had uncovered there was that there was some activity in one of the rooms right next to the meat locker where they kept some of the bodies of the Eastland disaster. Now, after the year 2000, when there was a plaque that had gone up, one of the things, Wild Bill, is that when you put up any kind of commemoration, the ghosts kind of calm down a little bit. Now, they've never calmed down altogether at the Eastland site.
Right.
But I
never saw no ghosts.
But they've definitely been reduced in reported activities, I guess is how I would say it. Except in that room, when I sensed the ghosts there, I told Bob Chin and asked him, well, what's going on in this room? And he's like, well, I don't really know. I've never been in there before. So he got an old skeleton key, unlocked, and
finding a dead rat or something.
Right, I know. Unlocked and opened the door, and we saw something pretty scary there, and that was an old mahogany desk. It looked like there was paperwork from maybe the 1910s, 1920s. I'm not really sure. Behind it was a rack with 15 hangman's nooses tied to it. My first thought, knowing that the city traffic court was there for years and years, was, wow, they were really uptight about traffic back then.
Trust me, they weren't.
Come to find out, we had uncovered the office of the hangman of the city of Chicago.
No kidding.
And apparently the ghosts are still active to this day.
I wish you had kept the paperwork, and I really do.
You know what? I actually know somebody who, I know the reporter who may be able to get it to you, so maybe
fantastic.
We can get this up, and we can
I would love to see what kind of paperwork the hangman had to do in the city of Chicago. There was
because they kept the
paperwork.
Ropes, they kept the paperwork,
right.
and actually it was Bob Chin himself, because he owned the entire places at
right.
that point before it
right.
sold.
They were certainly in the habit of keeping the ropes.
Oh, yeah, and it's and there was a rack. There was quite a few ropes on there. I begged him for one of the ropes. I mean, I hadn't seen anything so cool
you're
in a long
sick,
time.
Man.
I'm a really sick man.
I don't want a rope, a noose.
I thought it was pretty exciting. And but from what I understood, Bob had donated some of them, I think, to the Chicago Historical Museum and kept some himself.
Really?
That's what I had heard. Don't know if it's true or not. It's one of these things that's, again, hearsay
right.
and rumor.
But you saw it. You saw
yeah,
it. With
yeah,
your
saw
it
with my own eyes. Saw the hangman's ropes
all right. there was,
tied to the rack.
A county execution clerk. My guess is that was probably his office.
His office? Okay.
There were
at least storage for the ropes,
for
at the very
thing.
Least.
Yeah. Yeah. A lot of times they just kept that kind of crap in the sheriff's office. And
maybe they moved it over there.
He would pull out the grimy ropes and show them to people every now and then. Well, they tried to figure out how they should tie this one. There are a lot of reported
was it
debates.
In the same area where the green chair was kept? Have you heard that story about the green chair?
I do know the green chair story. I don't think it was the same place.
It's not the same
that
place.
That was a little bit later on.
Okay.
That was probably after they moved everything to the jails on 26 in California.
Oh, yeah. Well, it looks like time is escaping from us here, Bill. But I wanted to thank you for coming on the show today, everybody.
Thank you. You're too kind.
Not at all. Everybody, this is William Wild Bill Griffith, and he's the author of the new book, Fatal Drop, True Tales from the Chicago Gallows. Everybody, my name is Ken Melvoin Berg, psychic detective, and I wanted to say goodbye for myself and for Adam Seltzer, who is in Los Angeles right now.
This is William Wild Bill Griffith, pseudonym.
That's right, and let's we'll say goodbye to Betty. Betty, it was wonderful seeing you, Betty.
Good night.
Good night, Betty.
Good night, Mrs. Griffith.
Good night, Mrs.
Wherever
Griffith.
Wherever you are. Neighborhood gives me the creeps. Your neighborhood gives me the creeps. Check them out online,
WeirdChicago.com.
And read their book and mine.
That's right.
Station playing enough of the revolving door all-stars. Does your neighborhood give you the creeps? Have you been injured in an accident? Are you as constipated as I am? Because if so, you may be entitled to some...